meeting of the Environment and Natural Resources Finance Division will come to order. A quorum is present, which we will need because we're going to do a little business today. The first order of business are the minutes, and Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move approval of the minutes from the February 20th meeting.
Representative Fisher moves approval of the minutes from the February 20th, 2020, 2020 meeting. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. Minutes are approved. So our first bill today is from Representative Morrison. So the just through the today's meeting is we have Representative Morrison, then we're going to have an overview from the Board of Water and Soil Resources, then we'll have Representative Tabke, and then finishing up with my bill, which would be one requiring a vote to go to Ways and Means. I am going to have to step out at some point to go to the Transportation Committee, and I know there are other members that have bills as well. So Representative Claflin will be chairing in my absence. So Representative Morrison, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, House File 3524 appropriates funds to Bowser to continue the Lawns to Legumes program that was initiated last year.
And Representative Morrison, you need to move your bill.
Oh, sorry. I move that House File 3524, I think, will be laid over for inclusion in a future bill. The Lawns to Legumes program was passed into law last year in response to the drastic decline in pollinators in general and the rusty-patched bumblebee specifically. Research has shown that urban and suburban areas can play actually a key role in pollinator preservation and resurrection. Traditional lawns are problematic for pollinators for several reasons. They need to be mowed frequently, often require fertilizers and herbicides that can leach into ground and surface water. They don't retain rainwater well and provide no benefits for our endangered pollinators. Replacing traditional grass lawns with pollinator-friendly habitat, ideally for native flowering plants and legumes, provides nutrition and habitat for pollinators. The program has been well received in Minnesota and created national and even international buzz. The cost share grant program offers workshops, coaching, planting guides, and cost share funding for installing pollinator friendly native plantings and residential lawns. It's funded by the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund dollars, and my understanding is that there has been canceled funding from LCCMR. I don't serve on LCCMR. But we're asked, I believe it's in $2.8 million, and so we're asking for $900,000 from that surplus.
Representative Morrison, we have a question. Representative Fabian? Oh. Peter thought you were raising your hand.
And I
proceed.
I believe we have someone, Dan Shaw, here to talk about. Oh, here he is. Yeah.
And just members and members of the public, Representative Morrison had referenced cancellation in the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. There's a memo in your packet describing the rationale for that. There's been some confusion that we were canceling the prior Lawns to Legumes appropriation, and we are not doing that. Mr. Shaw.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Dan Shaw with the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources, and I'm a senior ecologist with the agency. So I'll be giving a brief overview of the current program. It has three components that I'll be describing. So as Representative Morrison mentioned, this program is funded through the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. The program is focused on establishing pollinator habitat in residential landscapes. It's focused on benefiting pollinators that are at risk. And so there's a real focus on the rusty patch bumblebee, which is a federally endangered species, and Minnesota's new state bee. All these pollinators play really important roles for food production and for sustaining our native ecosystems. And so that's part of the reason that, as an agency, we've been very focused on pollinator habitat. So this program has three different components. The first component is demonstration neighborhoods. And these are focused on establishing projects across neighborhoods and pollinator corridors that play important roles for the rusty patch bumblebee and other at-risk species. We currently approve funding for 13 demonstration neighborhoods across the state. The second component of the program is individual support. And this includes combinations of cost share funding for residents, workshops, signage, free planting guides. And so this is available to anybody across the state that has land and wants to apply for this program. Currently, we have 5,000 people that have, roughly 5,000 people. We think it'll be 5,000 by tomorrow, which is the end of the first application period, that have applied for this this assistance. So there has been a large response from the public around the state. The final component is a social media campaign, which is focused on increasing awareness about the need for habitat for at-risk pollinators and getting the messages out about the resources that are available through this program. This part of the program has been featured in Oprah Magazine, Minnesota Public Radio. There's been a lot of social media activity around this program and a large number of articles as well focus on the Lawns to Legumes program. Our experience so far is that the public has been very excited about this program. We've been hearing from a lot of the public with the program. We're hearing from them that they're seeing it as a way that they can assist in helping at-risk pollinators, but also increasing soil health, water quality benefits of their landscapes, overall increasing the resiliency of residential landscapes. Thank you.
Members, are there any questions? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned the areas around the state. You said that, I think the number used was 1,300 or something, demonstration sites or something. Can you go back through that again for me?
Sure, Mr. Chair, members. So that's the demonstration neighborhoods part of the program. And so we're setting up these neighborhood projects around the state to focus on pollinator corridors. And so there's 13 of them that have been approved for funding so far around the state. And the number of individual landowners that each one is working with varies. I would say on average, they probably have about 20 landowners for each of these demonstration neighborhoods.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then you said about 20 in each of those demonstration areas. Have you actually done grants or something to them to begin this process, or where are we at?
Mr. Shaw.
For these demonstration neighborhoods, it was a request for a proposal that went out for this program, and cities, counties, watershed districts, conservation districts, tribes, and nonprofits could all apply for these grants. And so they're the applicants for the funding, and then they're working individually with the landowners for these demonstration neighborhoods.
I'm good for now, thank you.
Representative Wagenius and then Representative Sandel.
As you're reaching out in your education program and folks who don't want grants necessarily but just want help, do you have things like, or will you be doing things like, I see on my neighbor's garage a little house for native bees, that, you know, little tubes that native bees can go in. Are you also promoting things like that for folks who will not be in your grant system?
Mr. Chair and members, that's a good question. Right from the beginning, as we started this program, we're hearing from a lot of residents that wanted to start projects on their own. And so we developed a habitat guide, planting templates, a lot of different technical resources that they could use just to get started on their own. And I think that's a real benefit of the program, is that we're providing funding, but there's such interest out there that we see that people are starting these projects on their own. And another key part of this program is that it's really a partnership with all the conservation agencies in the state and different organizations. And that includes groups like Xerxes Society and others that are experts on pollinator habitat. So it's been a really good opportunity to partner with them on their technical information and just broadening the technical assistance that's happening for all these landowners.
Representative Wagenius.
So is there an easy way for a citizen who is sitting home on their computer to find this information and get the, all the links that they would like?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Members, yes, we have a website through the Board of Water and Soil Resources where we have all these resources listed. And then we're partnering with the Blue Thumb Partnership, which is a group of public and private conservation groups, about 50 of them. And they are assisting with the individual support as well. And they have an application for the individual support on their website.
I'm just...
Representative McGinnis.
Thank you. I'm just... a lot of folks just want to do it, and they don't want to go through the process. Mm-hmm. They want to be part of what you're doing. They want to be part of it. So having a Boy Scout group ready or to build a little nest for bees, is there something there that tells them how to do that? Or if, those are the kinds of things that I'm thinking the public would really like.
Mr. Chair, members, specific with the nesting boxes, I don't know that we currently have a resource up for that, but I think we could add one because we do have resources on converting lawns to pollinator lawns, establishing pollinator meadows, and so there's a lot of different project types that we've been promoting, and so I think that would be a good addition to have information on nesting boxes, and Xerxes Society has information on that that we can link to. And so I think that would be a good addition to have some information on that.
Just remind members, you know, for posterity and the permanent record, to almost eat the microphone so that people can hear it and, you know, from years from now when they want to come back and check what we have said, they'll be able to follow. Representative McGinnis?
No, just thank you, Mr. Chair. I just... Citizens want to be involved, and I just want to make sure it's really easy for them.
Mr. Shaw.
I'll just add one other thing. So one thing we have on our website is there's a mapping tool now. So anybody that receives funding can map their projects, but then there's another icon for anybody that has done a project on their own can map their project as well. Mm-hmm. And there's also signage for the program, and so we'll be getting signage out to anybody that receives funding. But we're also trying to raise additional funding to get signs out to people doing it on their own as well.
Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Shaw, I live in a district which is highly residential, and we have three golf courses in our area as well as three across the lines. I got a call from a constituent yesterday who's a beekeeper and said that all her bees had died. And she said the reason that it had is that the pesticides which are being used either on lawns or golf courses have drifted over to her property. Is there a pesticide, or is there a city ordinance, or how can we protect people who are interested in a project like this, who are interested in promoting pollinators and establishing an environment that where they thrive, can be protected rather than be vulnerable to pesticides which know boundaries?
Mr. Shaw.
Mr. Chair and members, that's a good question, and the pesticides have been on our mind through this as we've developed this program. So we do have requirements for any of these plantings that are done that they need to be protected from pesticides. We're really concerned about nearby pesticide use for the plantings that are done through this program. We've been working with Xerxes Society. We have a new document on protecting conservation lands from insecticide use. And the focus of that is looking at strategies that can be used as part of design to minimize impacts to conservation plantings. And it is definitely a topic that we've been thinking about as we work with cities as well. There's, I believe, around 40 cities in the state that do have pollinator resolutions that where they're restricting the use of pesticides within those cities. And so that is an option for cities to look at to kind of work with their ordinances and try to restrict insecticide use.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one follow-up question. the beekeeper called yesterday. Last session, I had the golf course representatives in my office, and they were cordial people and pleasant. And they said they were being responsible with their pesticides and herbicides. Does that sound right to you? Or I mean, I don't want to pick a fight with those people. I want them to be prosperous. But can pesticides and herbicides be used commercially without causing problems like the one I mentioned earlier?
Mr. Shaw.
Mr. Chair and members, I think probably the main thing for a business like that is to ensure that they're following the prescriptions of the herbicides that they're using, that they're following the labels, that they're following state rules around pesticides, you know, and if those are being followed carefully, then they shouldn't be having drift go off of the site. You know, they're following the wind prescriptions and things like that. And so those would be the key things, I think, for them to be following.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Heintzman and then Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Seidel's point or question brought up a few things just quickly. I ordered my bees about 2 months ago, and so we're getting ready. We're excited. They're going to be coming just around the corner. But I will tell you that hive collapse during wintertime is something that folks all over the state experience, and it may or may not be in every case connected to a problem like what your constituent was mentioning. Something that we continue to talk about, no question, and it's important. But I often will ask people what commonly kept honeybee species is native to Minnesota, and the answer to the question is none.
Yeah.
So in this climate, you're going to be looking at trying to support numerous pollinators, not just the commonly kept honeybee species. And the native species, of course, are much more resilient during winter as opposed to your commonly kept bees. So lots of beekeepers, professionals, and otherwise struggle to keep their hives alive all winter.
Thank you.
Representative Wagenius.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. To be clear on what a city can do, a city can say, these are the pollinator-friendly cities, they can say, we're no longer going to be using pesticides on our properties, or our parks are not going to be using them or going to be limiting them. But the state law preempts cities from making ordinances that say no pesticides. That's a state law. It's about a 30-year-old law. Chair knows more about it than I do, for sure. I actually have a bill in the Ag Committee that would allow cities to be exempt from that preemption. So, and on the native bees, I think they may be more resilient to winter, but they're less resilient to pesticides, actually.
Mr. Shaw, I had a question, and you may have said it, but so we appropriated $900,000, and we're kind of in that first round. How much in terms of dollars? I think you said in terms of applicants, but how much in terms of dollars have been requested?
Mr. Chair and members, for the demonstration neighborhoods, we had 34 applications come in, and we funded 13, so I'm trying to remember exactly what the dollar amount was. So we funded about $400,000 worth of those projects through the funding that we had available, and it was a little over double that for the requests that we had for that funding. And for the individual support, we can fund around 1,000 people currently with the funding that we have, and we have about 5,000 people signed up, and this is just the first of three rounds. So our goal is to get, thank you. So our goal is to hopefully have around 10,000 people signed up for this individual support by the end of the 3 years, And currently we can fund about 1,000 of those people that have applied. And that is statewide. We are getting applications around the state. And the amount for the demonstration neighborhood request was $1,123,000.
So Mr. Shaw, just for the demonstration neighborhoods, you've had more in request than the total appropriation from last year.
That is correct.
And then on the individual dollars, you don't have that amount, but it's obviously greater than the appropriate. So Representative Morrison's bill is asking for an additional $900,000. So the question is, would that be able to be used? Is that enough?
Well, it's not enough for the current demand that we have with the program as part of the demonstration neighborhoods and the individual support. And we are expecting more interest from other cities on demonstration neighborhoods as more awareness has gotten out about the program. And there's been increasing awareness from the public as well about the individual support.
Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on House File 3524? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Shaw, I'm curious. You talk about 13 projects and so forth. I'm wondering how many individual plots there are on the ground that are being planned in this first round. And, Mr. Chair, it was $900,000 the first time around.
Yes.
Okay, correct. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, through the individual support, we think we can fund around 1,000 projects. So that would be about 1,000 residents that are receiving funding through that part of the program. The demonstration neighborhoods, again, there's about 13, or there are 13 projects that have been approved for funding, and probably around an average of 20 landowners involved per project. So that would be 260 landowners that would be involved in that part of the project. Those will tend to be somewhat larger projects on those properties than the individual support projects, because $350 plus the cost share is only going to go so far for individual landowners. And those are estimates on the numbers. Not everybody will use the full $350, so we might have some additional landowners that could receive funding, so that'll evolve as the program progresses.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Shaw, how many acres do you think will be planted into this program?
Mr. Chair and members, we've had a hard time estimating the number of acres. We have projects that will be ranging from relatively small plantings, and for people that are new to this, we've suggested that they start small and add to it over time, and then some of these will be up to 3 acres, and so it'll be somewhere in between as an average between those numbers for the size of the individual properties. But the other thing to note with these is that these are high value plantings for pollinators, that these are going to be flower dense areas, and so it's not as much about the acreage as the quality of the plantings.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what are you, of the 900,000, what percentage of that is being used for administrative costs?
Mr. Shaw.
With the 900,000, so we have $400,000 that's going to the demonstration neighborhoods, about another $400,000 that's going to the individual support. So there's about $100,000 that is going to administration, but then also the outreach and technical resources and all the other parts that we've developed to assist people that are working on their own with these projects.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 3524? Representative Morris. Representative Heinzman.
I have a. Okay.
Or. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just, okay, so 3524, we got the cancellation on here. Are we going to get any testimony on the cancellation from the Sauk River people, or we're just doing it?
Representative Fabian, that, and we could have Ms. Nash come forward from LCCMR to explain that decision's been made, that they've canceled the project, and it's done, and that money is available. But
that's fine. It doesn't have to. But
maybe let's just get it on the record so it's done, since you asked.
So my other question, while she's coming up, then is, when are we going to? I mean, we're doing this for LCCMR, but as I understand, there's not an LCCMR bill, or is there?
There will be. There will be.
So what's the plan?
The plan is that there will be a bill that has what passed but was not recommended, and I will author it minus the wastewater treatment component that was there. There will be $2.7 million that were canceled from this prior project. The LCCMR voted last January, or a month ago, I guess, to say that the legislature should determine how that $2.7 million will be met. So we will be hearing bills like this bill. And I mentioned at the LCCMR, Representative Heintzman and Tice were there about one thing. I've asked the MPCA to actually present a bill for the full accounting of the PFAS proposal that was cut in LCCMR. So I think it asked for $1.5 million and was cut to $1 million.
So, Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with what the LCCMR is doing. So you've had a year of hearings and testimony and stuff in this room, and the LCCMR doesn't have a recommendation. Is that what I'm hearing?
Representative Fabian, there were not the 12 votes needed to pass a recommendation. There were enough votes to pass it with a majority, but not enough votes to make a recommendation. So there is no recommended package.
So, well, does that happen? That hasn't happened before. I'm just going to say that hasn't happened before. Maybe.
I would maybe check with Representative Wagenius, who would have, I'm not sure on that question. Maybe Ms. Nash could answer that question.
Mr. Chair and members, it appears it has happened before. We know at least one time that it did happen where there was not a recommendation.
So in the and I served on LCCMR, and it's kind of similar to Lasard Sam's council, how we hear projects and so forth. Are we going to go, as a committee, are we going to go through that process and take testimony from all of the proposers?
Representative Fabian, no.
So then why do we have a LCCMR? Why doesn't the legislature just do it, period? I mean, how many tax dollars has the state of Minnesota on the hook for holding meetings for a year, and we don't come to a consensus? That's troubling to me.
Well, Representative Fabian, it may be troubling, but it's the fact. And the fact is there is not a recommendation. The vote was taken last summer. The votes have not changed. What will come in front of this committee are what has passed, minus the wastewater treatment, which was thoroughly debated last year. And you will have the projects in there that passed that were not recommended. The wastewater treatment project was not supported by the Public Facilities Authority. It was never, did not go through the process. Was not submitted, and it was added at the end. So I will not be including that in my bill. Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a clarification for folks then. Mr. Chair, you mentioned that the recommendations as passed but not fully supported will be going forward. Isn't it true that the wastewater treatment facility money also passed with a majority and was included until you've now indicated that you're going to remove it?
That is correct.
Okay. So,
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Nash, can you get me an accounting of how much money we've spent through this process, please, for per diems and mileage and whatever, to you know, to put on all these meetings and go out and all the site visits and all that, please?
Mr. Chair, members, yes, I can do that for you.
Thank you.
And Ms. Nash, could you get to the first question just on the process?
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, Becca Nash, the director of the LCCMR, Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources. I just can confirm that there is approximately $2.768 million available this year for Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. We were notified by the city of Melrose, who had received an appropriation through the legislative session last year. We were notified by them that they would no longer be able to proceed with that project. And so they provided us with a copy of a city resolution basically rescinding those funds. So they did, we had communication with them over about 10 months where they were trying to find alternate plans for that funding. But then in December, they did notify us of their final decision. They came before the commission at our January meeting. And at that time, the LCCMR voted supermajority, 15 members present. They voted to elect to have the legislature determine the fate of those funds. So those funds are available now until June 30th, 2022.
Anyone else on House File 3524? President Morrison, to close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Thank you for considering continuing the Lawns to Legumes program that has had an important role in transforming traditional lawns and educating Minnesotans about the importance of protecting pollinators.
Representative Morrison renews her motion that House File 3524 be laid over for possible inclusion in the future bill. The bill is laid over. Next, we will have an overview of the Conservation Reserve Program and the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program. Ms. Doucette and Ms. Becker-Kadelka, and I am going to be going to the Transportation Committee, so Vice Chair Claflin will be running the meeting.
Madam Chair and members, for the record, Angie Becker-Kadelka, Assistant Director with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. And with me today?
Sharon Doucette, Easement Section Manager at Bowser.
Madam Chair and members, today we were asked to come and speak about the history and details of the Conservation Reserve Program and the Minnesota CREP Program. Just as the quick background, and as this committee knows, Bowser's focus is really on private lands, which make up around 75% of the state. And we get our work done because of the local governments, the soil and water districts and the watershed districts that live and work locally on the ground to deliver these practices. So the two programs we'll be providing a brief history and overview today is the Conservation Reserve Program and the CREP Program.
I will be first talking about the Conservation Reserve Program. The Conservation Reserve Program, commonly referred to as CREP, is a federal is a federal USDA program through the Farm Service Agency, or FSA. CRP is an important conservation tool nationwide, and Minnesota has historically attempted to maximize this program by leveraging state dollars to make CRP an attractive option for landowners. The basics of CRP. It is a federal program. It is a voluntary program that works with agricultural producers to enroll in 10 to 15 year contracts. Through those contracts, the land that is enrolled is no longer farmed and instead devoted to practices that have conservation benefits. CRP participants establish long-term resource-conserving plantings, such as trees and grasses, that control erosion, improve water quality, and provide wildlife habitat, including pollinator habitat. In return, FSA provides the participants with rental payments and cost-share assistance. History for CRP. CRP was first introduced by the Food Security Act in 1985 and has been reauthorized several times since then, most recently in 2018 with the Agricultural Improvement Act, or the 2018 Federal Farm Bill. CRP is the largest conservation program in the country. There are two major sign-up types through the CRP program. There is a general CRP that includes deadlines for submission from landowners, as well as continuous CRP. Program rules under the latest 2018 Farm Bill are still evolving. The programs implemented by FSA are on behalf of the USDA's Commodity Credit Corporation. The 2018 Federal Farm Bill established a national enrollment cap of 27 million acres. At the end of 2019, there were 22 million acres currently enrolled, allowing for an additional 5 million acres of enrollment nationwide, without consideration for any contract expiration. Currently, there are over just 1 million acres in Minnesota enrolled in CRP. In return for establishing that long-term conservation cover, FSA provides annual rental payments to the participants. These rental rates are based on the relative productivity of the soils within each county and the average cash rental rate using data provided by the National Agricultural Statistics Service. The current sign-up has seen several changes from previous sign-ups. One is that soil rental rates have been changed based on current cash rental value. The second is that the soil rental rate, which is calculated on a dollar value per acre, is prorated for this sign-up of the CRP program. General sign-up contracts are receiving 85% of that soil rental rate, and continuous contracts are receiving 90% of the soil rental rate. In contrast, in 2017, there was an incentive payment to the soil rental rate of 20%. And in 2018, payments were using just 100% of the soil rental rate. Other incentive payments, including the sign-up incentive payment, as well as the practice incentive payment, have also been modified for this sign-up. So what does that mean for a landowner in terms of contract money? This example shows if the 2020 soil rental rate for that particular county for a contract was determined to be $175 per acre, the 90% payment reduction, the 90% payment for that CRP contract for a continuous sign-up would result in a $157.50 acre per payment rate. And maybe $157.50 doesn't seem like a significant amount, but when you take that $17.50 per acre decrease, multiply that by the average size of a continuous CRP sign-up of 14 acres and 15 years of payments, that's $3,675 less that the landowner is receiving over the life of that contract compared to a sign-up from just last year. And why is this important in Minnesota? Because CRP enrollment acres have steadily decreased in Minnesota since achieving their peak in 2007, resulting in a loss of 700,000 CRP acres between 2007 and 2018. Over the next 5 years, there are more than 350,000 CRP contract acres in Minnesota that are expiring. On average, approximately 50% of those acres maintain conservation cover through re-enrollment in CRP. Without new signups, that's a significant loss of acreage for wildlife habitat and water quality benefits in Minnesota.
So now let's marry up the federal CRP program with the Minnesota CREP. So the Minnesota CREP, or Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program, combines the federal CRP with the state RIM program. The state RIM program, the Reinvest in Minnesota RIM Reserve, was a program established by the legislature back in 1986. And the program is an easement program where the land stays in private ownership, but the state holds an easement on that land. Another part, a component of the RIM Reserve program is that it includes restoration. So it's not just the stopping of a cropland practice, but it's also restoration of the area. So together, CRP and RIM Reserve make the Minnesota CREP. So this program was developed and it was championed by a coalition of over 71 organizations in Minnesota. And I see some of them in the room. I see Pheasants Forever and Ducks Unlimited and TNC, the Nature Conservancy, along with local government partners, soil and water districts and watershed districts. And that is where the Minnesota CREP started back in 2015. Then the program was vetted by the legislature and this committee today, and via the predecessor of chair of this committee, began to direct resources through this committee to show the state's interest and commitment in bringing federal dollars to the state. In 2017, the program was signed by the governor of Minnesota and the USDA agriculture secretary. So the scope of the program, it's a 54 county area. It is voluntary, so it's landowners who are interested, and it prioritizes only three conservation practices on marginal land. So it prioritizes filter strips, it prioritizes wetland restorations, and it prioritizes wellheads for drinking water, so wellhead protection areas. And it's also targeted to the most critical acres. So this is an application process and an environmental benefit scoring. To date, we have 24,000 acres enrolled in the program. We had signups available in the summer of 2018 and in the summer of 2019. Because of the new farm bill, the federal government stopped signups there in between as they were developing new rules and new programs. So we so far have been able to have two sets of signups in this program. We are anticipating our next signup to start next month. What does that look like financially? So of those 24,000 acres, 94% of those resources, of the funds of this program, go out directly to landowners. The other 6%, a little less than 6%, include things like restoration cost, it's the engineering, the construction, it's payments to SWCDs to manage the program, it's easement processing, mapping, administration, those sorts of things. Those 24,000 acres have $175 million investment, including $72 million in RIM payments, $98.5 million in CRP payments, and then for all of those other things I just talked about, around $10 million. Just to note, this doesn't include all of the federal costs. We haven't been able to account totally for the federal costs by the way they do their accounting systems, and so they have discussed with us ways that they might be able to share some of the other things they provide, like some of the restoration and work that they do. So then what does this look like? So the federal CRP program and the state RIM program come together to form CREP and have specific roles. So the federal program provides landowner payments and things like practice incentive payments, restoration, cost share, those things. The state's responsible then for the rest of that to make up the easement payment, works on practice payments. The state responsibility is for technical assistance, easement acquisition, engineering, and any sort of roundouts. And a roundout are those areas that don't have cropping history but are necessary in order to form a full CREP easement. So like a wet area maybe that was never farmed, but it's the depression. So if you're going to do a wetland restoration, you need that wet area in with the easement. The state so far has invested $158.5 million into the program. There have been four funds contributing, as lined out in the process early on, included the Clean Water Fund, the Outdoor Heritage Fund, bonding, and then the LCCMR. So right now we are $16.5 million from reaching the state investment of $175 million. And the governor has recommended a bonding bill of $16.5 million to finish out the state's investment. We're also learning about what applicants want out of the Minnesota CREP. So, for example, this is Lorelei and her husband, Ron Westby. And her dad's land out in West Ottertail County was land that she was worried about having development on it. And so she said that her dad's wish before he passed away was that it's protected from that development. And so one of the things that they were looking for was a way to bring in protection and then also restore it for wildlife habitat. We know that there's a demand for Minnesota CREP. So far we've had over $214 million in applications. And that most recent sign-up, which was last summer, before the federal government had us pause, that most recent sign-up lasted less than 4 weeks and had over $20 million in requests. And so we know that there's interest out there from voluntary landowners that want to participate. We know there's economic benefits. This is a driver locally. So this money comes in from the feds and from the state and goes out to landowners who then also are paid to do the restoration. So they hire contractors to help move dirt. They go to the seed company and buy seed to plant and provides economic cycling within the community. It's also clean water benefits. The 24,000 acres are resulting in reductions of over 7,000 pounds of phosphorus, sediment, nitrogen. And we're starting to calculate the greenhouse gas reductions. So overall, this is around stacking benefits. It keeps soil on the land. It provides temporary water storage in some places and helps protect vulnerable drinking water. It enhances grasslands and wetlands habitat, and it sequesters carbon. And with that, Madam Chair, we would stand for any questions.
Thank you very much, Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you. You brought up the issue of protecting drinking water, and we have over 400,000 acres of vulnerable land around drinking water wells that have been identified by the Department of Health. With all of this money, how many of those acres have you protected?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm not sure, and I don't know if easement manager Doucette knows the number off the top of my head. I can get you that number. One of the things we've learned about the wellhead protection areas is that landowners, we found that because that's oftentimes really good farmland, that landowners have been less inclined to want to enroll in the CREP for the amount of money that the state can pay for that. And so we're starting to partner with other organizations like Rural Water and the Department of Health and looking at opportunities for how we might be able to provide enough of an incentive for that to be for another payment by maybe a local entity to be stacked on top of the Minnesota CREP.
Representative Guineas.
If you can't tell us how many acres have been protected, how much of your dollar has been spent on those vulnerable acres? Because given 400,000, mm-hmm. there's certainly not every piece of that is great farmland. That's not true.
Ms. Becker.
Madam Chair and Representative, yes, in fact, the wetland restoration areas and the filter strip areas are mostly marginal farmland. So that's the part that isn't getting a good crop anyway. It was the wellhead protection areas. I can get you both the dollar amount and the acres, and I just don't have those practice numbers right in front of me.
And Madam Chair, and I can chime in and say that I certainly can get you the actual numbers and dollars, but on average what we have seen in practice type for application by acres is that a vast majority of the applications that we have received for CREP are coming in as wetland restoration in the order of 90%+ of the applications. And so buffer strips and wellhead protection, it makes up that remaining portion. The one thing, as Angie mentioned, we are exploring additional opportunities to facilitate wellhead protection. One of the things that we started last year is a wellhead partner protection grant program that allows a community or a partner locally to tell us how they would protect a wellhead area and provide some of their funding as well to a different option than a RIM easement, including things like fee acquisition.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, the reason I asked this question is altogether you are spending between state and federal dollars how much money?
Ms. Kadalka.
Madam Chair and Representative, so far the payments to landowners have been $170 million.
But you will, when all together, you will spend what in this?
Ms. Becker-Kadalka.
Madam Chair, it's around a $500 million program.
The reason I bring that up is I recognize that it was around $500 million, and I think the proposal was for them to spend $6 million on drinking water, which, given the drinking water problems in the state, seems extraordinarily low to me. So it will be good to hear the report back of how many dollars were spent and how many acres were protected.
Are there other questions from the committee members? Thank you very much, Ms. Becker-Gadalka and Ms. Doucette. Next, we will hear House File 3431 from Representative Tadke, State Incentives for Conservation Reserve Program Funding. I will move House File 3431 be recommended to be referred to the Energy and Climate Finance and Policy Division. Representative Tadke, please present your bill.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Today with House File 3431, this is part of, I'm part of the Climate Action Caucus, and this is part of a host of bills that have been put forward this year to work on the urgent need of climate change mitigation in Minnesota. And so I was really happy to carry this portion of the bill for Conservation Reserve Program. I'm a farm kid from Iowa, and we had a significant amount of CRP land while I was growing up, and a lot of that has gone away, and there are extraordinary benefits to having land in CRP throughout rural America, including, well, as you just heard, I was unable to see a majority of what they were speaking about today, but if I had been here, I assume they're talking about the benefits to soil, the benefits to wildlife, the benefits to water and air quality that having land and conservation reserve really helps with throughout Minnesota. And it's not a competing program with cropland. It's not a competing program with other farming activities. And it's a very good value add that we can do here in Minnesota. So as part of this bill, we are asking for $6.5 million in fiscal 2021 appropriated from the general fund to the Board of Water and Soil Resources to provide one-time state payments to enrollees in the Federal Conservation Reserve Program.
Thank you very much, Representative Tadke. And your testifiers, we begin with Mr. Joe Duggan from Pheasants Forever. I'm sorry, Mr. Duggan, if I mispronounced your name. And please introduce yourself with the correct pronunciation for the record.
Good afternoon, committee. My name is Joe Duggan. It says I'm retired from Pheasants Forever. I still do some consulting work there. I spent about 25 years at Pheasants Forever. It's an organization that probably many of you are familiar with, but it started here in Minnesota and it's grown to become a national conservation organization. And I was very much involved through over the years and had a great career, and I'm still involved in a ways that hopefully will be bringing good conservation to the ground. CRP is a program, as you just heard, that has done that in spades, and we've seen it go up and down over the years, and one of the things that I think is kind of interesting is you watch wildlife populations, and they kind of go right in sync with what's happening with the CRP contract, particularly in the western and the ag regions of Minnesota. One of the things that I found interesting in my career, I'm an avid outdoorsman, I like to hunt, I like to fish. That's part of the reason why I wanted to get involved in conservation, I wanted to give back. Working in trying to propagate pheasants through conservation is what we try to do. The interesting thing to me is how what's good for pheasants, what's good for deer, what's good for pollinators ends up having to be good for water, good for flood water retention. There are numerous benefits to the CRP program. So on behalf of Pheasants Forever and its 25,000 members in Minnesota, we firmly support this legislation and encourage its passage. One of the other important things I think that I've learned over the years is leveraging dollars. It's very hard to get things done without a lot of partners. In this case, we have the largest partner in the world financially, that's the U.S. government. Minnesota, as I recall, I think I learned this a couple of years ago, I don't know if it's still today, but I suspect, is a net exporter of revenue to Washington, D.C. So that means what This bill will bring some of those federal dollars back to the state of Minnesota, and in doing it, it'll be a multiplier. So, for a lot of reasons, I think we need to move forward with this. I get around the state a lot. I've seen a lot of great projects on the ground, and we have a lot of issues that can be addressed through CRP. And the combination of CRP with RIM, the CREP program is a dramatic, can be dramatic results on the ground. Representative Wiegney has brought up a very good point about drinking water problems. I get to Southwest Minnesota a lot. I have a lot of friends that have farmland down there that have wells that have problems that the city of Adrian, the city of Ellsworth, the city of Worthington that goes on all have problems with nitrates. CRP is not the only solution, but it is a great solution when it gets targeted in ways to benefit water, and I think that should also be part of what we're doing here. The issues with pollinators, there's endless, and we've got a great tool here, and we've got an opportunity to put some money on the table to make these contracts of interest to farmers and landowners, and for a little bit of extra incentive on the state side, I think we can dramatically increase the revenue coming from the federal side to get some of these important values on the landscape.
Thank you, Mr. Dugan. Mr. Mark Henry from Pheasants Recovery.
We'll see.
Welcome, and please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Mark Henry. I'm a longtime resident of Dakota County. I presently sit on the Dakota County Fair Board, the Ag Society. We have a 193-acre conservation easement with Dakota County that I tend to be the steward for. We have 22 acres of CRP also. I also sit on the Vermilion River Watershed Planning Commission. I'm the chair this year. We have some grave concerns about water in Dakota County. I grew up on the south branch of the Vermilion River, and we know that that is a major contributor to nitrates. We're looking and struggling, trying to figure out ways to deal with that. It bothers me that city governments like Hastings have to put in reverse osmosis systems to reduce nitrates that we know are starting 20 miles upstream. By the way, just to mention this, Mr. Dugan is one of my mentors. I started my PF chapter in Dakota County 25 years ago, and I appreciate his good steward or his good leadership with me over the years. Whenever I went to a landowner and talked to them about a practice, I'm all about pheasants. I grew up hunting pheasants in the Big Slough. That's what the South Branch is called historically. 50 years ago I started. I still tramp around there the best I can, even with my age and other physical issues. But that being said, we have so many concerns in Dakota County about natural areas. I'm very proud of what my county has done moving forward. We identified the problem with the buffers in 2012 and put a practice in place to try and move that forward. Since then, the state has taken that on. My watershed, we have identified areas that have problems, and we're looking for every tool we can to fix those problems. And one of those is CRP. When I grew up around 1985, I remember the Big Slough being surrounded by CRP, hundreds and hundreds of acres. Now it's basically gone. To make a living, I do road maintenance. And one of the things that I constantly see is soils moving into the right-of-way that need to be removed. And it costs everybody. If we can target areas where those soils will stay on the land, it's better for everyone. It's not just about birds. It's about costs. I'll give you a quick example. Last year, I mean, I physically do this. I'm the guy that gets in the road grader, blades the roads, and plows the roads. Last year, I put in a centerline pipe in the south end of my township. 15 years ago, we had put in a subsurface drainage system to remove frost boils in the spring. We put in drain tile. When I went to put this new centerline pipe in that had collapsed, the soil that had moved into that drainage system had completely blocked that vast investment that the town had made, meaning I'm going to have to try and figure out this year how to remove a lot of soils to get that drainage system working again so we don't have the frost boil issues in the coming years. And we invested a lot of money in that. In roughly 15 years, that soil has moved that much. I wonder if we were able to retain it upstream, if we would have less problems there. One more thing I'll say. I'm all about habitat. I'm a pheasant hunter. But whenever I approach somebody, I always made sure that things like water quality and soil retention are the primary. Birds will come with habitat, or bees, or whatever. I guess that's primarily what I had to say today.
Thank you, Mr. Henry. And Ms. Sheila Vanny. Welcome, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, Sheila Vanny. I'm the Assistant Director with the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts, and I want to thank Representative Tabke for bringing this bill forward, as well as Representative Hansen with the bill that follows. On behalf of Minnesota's 88 Soil and Water Conservation Districts, we want to share with you our perspective that the Conservation Reserve Program, CRP, is an important tool for getting additional conservation on the land, as well as maintaining conservation land that's already there. We do have, across Minnesota, roughly 70 of our SWCDs are co-located with our partners at USDA, so both the Natural Resources Conservation Service and the Farm Service Agency, who administers the CRP program, have a very strong working relationship with SWCD staff at the local level, and we've strived to maintain that over the years. We support efforts to make the program more financially beneficial to landowners and to make sure that they're getting enrolled or re-enrolled, as the case may be. And as this bill moves forward, we look forward to continuing to work on any language changes that may be needed or to work with the Board of Water and Soil Resources on how the practice payment incentives would get targeted. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any other folks in the audience who would like to testify for or against this bill? Well, welcome, and please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Lance Ness. I'm the president of the Minnesota Conservation Federation, the president of the Fish and Wildlife Legislative Alliance. We support House File 3431. We want to thank the author for bringing it forward. Just a quick note, I was a member of the original RIM Coalition back in a long time ago. I won't date myself, but it's been a while. And we've always supported CRIP, and we found it's very beneficial to wildlife habitat as well as pollinators. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify? Is there any discussion from members, any questions for Representative Tabke or any of the other testifiers? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Tabke, it says in your bill on line 1.8, it's going to be a one-time state incentive payment. How much is the payment?
Representative Tabke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Fabian, the payment will vary depending on per acre and what the program gets set up. There have to be rules, and it's all set up based on the Federal Conservation Reserve Program. I'm not sure exactly what that will be today, because that has to be set up as we move forward. But it's an appropriation of $6.5 million one-time funds moving forward.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you. Okay. So then in 1.12 and 1.13, it says the board may use state funds to implement the program. Does that mean that they can use the funds that they already have in their budgets, or are they going to take administrative costs out of the $6.5 million?
Representative Tabke?
That means that as it is needed, and it's not necessarily spelled out perfectly, in the bill, but yes, they can take administrative fees out of the $6.5 million.
Representative
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you don't have a cap on that in here anywhere, do you?
I do not.
Representative Tapke.
I do not, Representative Fagan.
Okay. And then the board, it says here, must consult with the Commissioners of Agriculture, Health, Natural Resources, and the Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Agriculture in establishing the program criteria. Well, we heard from the SWCDs who are here. Should they be included in the consulting?
Representative Tapke.
Madam Chair and Representative Fabian, they have not requested to be involved in those discussion, but it would not be a problem to have them involved for sure.
Okay. So, thank you, Madam Chair. And just my final, I think there's a lot of loose ends here. I don't know, Chair Hansen, do you have, I don't think you have a target yet, do you, for this committee?
Chair Hansen?
Madam Chair, and no Representative Fabian, but, you know, if we work together, I think we could try to support a large one.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, I'm not, I'm just waiting. I'm not speechless. Does that mean you and I get to set the target working together?
Madam Chair and Representative Fabian, seriously, I would like to talk to you about this because I think it, this is something that, and the bill coming up, and I can talk a little bit about there, but I think this is something that trying to attract federal dollars in and make it be effective is something we should do. And we have been working and asking the executive branch for support on this through a variety of the commissioners. And that's why you see a variety of them there, and as well as the SWCDs. And I can talk about that a little bit more. Representative Tapke is asking for a little more money that would go farther than I was. But I think it the need, that, as you heard, is going to be there for trying to attract this these dollars.
So how much do you anticipate? I'm sorry, Madam Chair, excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. So the one-time incentive payment, and I'm sure that's in your bill as well, what percentage of the federal payment do you think that's going to be?
Chair Hansen?
And if you want
Madam Chair, maybe we let Representative Tapke, and I could maybe just do that during the presentation.
Because my, we've traditionally had a significant amount of CRP in northwestern Minnesota. And when I talk to those producers who are looking at re-enrolling, quite frankly, folks, it's the majority of them are not re-enrolling because of what they're getting paid.
Yep.
They're not re-enrolling because the program has become so beastly burdensome and complicated, not just in how you get to having the CRP planted in the ground, but then how you have to maintain it and afterwards, and they're just saying we're not doing it. So for the conservation groups that are in the room, you need to work with the feds to get the restrictions and the requirements within that program so that it's easier to work with, because it's not. And they're just saying, I'm not doing it. So my problem with this is that I'd like to see more details of exactly how the money is going to be appropriated and so forth before I support the dollar amount. I'd like us to know what we're actually getting into rather than waiting for, again, the agencies to establish the criteria and so forth. I'd like to know what the criteria are first, and then we could take a look at it. Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Seeing none, Representative Tapke, would you like to make any closing remarks?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. As stated earlier, CRP programs are really good. I could not agree with Representative Fabian more that the burdens and the issues that come from the federal level on CRP are onerous and oftentimes unnecessary, in my opinion, and would love to have some action take place there. But seeing as though that we are here at the state level, that's beyond our purview for today, but we need to, it helps all communities throughout the state of Minnesota to have more ground within the CRP program helps. I'll just end it there. So thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And I will renew my motion that House File 3431 be recommended to be re-referred to the Energy and Climate Finance and Policy Division. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Nay.
No.
Nay.
No.
The motion prevails and on its way to Energy and Climate.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next, we will hear House File 2957. From Representative Hansen. Would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would move House File 2957 to go to the Ways and Means Committee. Members, and I think this Representative Fabian will go through a little bit of the why here. I do, before we start, though, I want to make sure and make it clear that I'm on the record here. A lot of the knowledge that I am going to talk about is my personal experience in going and applying for CRP this past winter. And so I've applied for re-enrollment, Representative Fabian, so I've walked through exactly what you're describing with re-enrollment for CRP. So this program and the program that Representative Tabke would be doing would require a landowner, if they're going to utilize this program, they would have to apply. I want to make sure it's clear that I would not apply for any incentive payment, that if this bill became law. I have two proposals that are in front of USDA. They will probably, and we never know with the federal government, but I would not be asking for the money that I am. I'm trying to get these dollars to incent other landowners to receive funds to encourage them to enroll.
Representative Fabian.
So just to be clear, Representative Hansen, out of your bill or out of Representative Tabke's bill? I'm kidding.
Both bills. I want to make sure I'm clear on that. Representative Fabian, exactly what you saw, and I went into FSA office and looked at land that was in for enrollment that I've had in, that I've managed, that I've burned. But the price that would come, what has happened in the current farm bill is that there's been a reallocation of the county land average, and it's generally lower. And I think this was probably discussed while I was in the other room, but most of the counties went lower. And then in addition, for general sign-up, there is a 15% under that lowered county average. And for continuous sign-up, there is a 10% lower than the county average. So you are getting land rental rates. So let's say you put land into CRP 10 years ago. You may have put it in, and I'll just use a hypothetical number. Let's say you put it in for $100 an acre, and you've got $100 for an acre, and you are going to get $135 an acre under the new enrollment, but you could open it up and farm it, and it could be $175 an acre that you could get on a rent. So you are not competing. You're not competitive with average rental rates in the reality in the market. So landowners may make that decision to convert it back into crop. So that investment is lost. In addition, if you were new and thinking of coming in, you're probably going to be less as well. I mean, your land rate is probably less than that. So you're actually not even, you might be a little higher than what you were getting 10 years ago if you're re-enrolling, but if you're taking out of production, you're probably more dramatically less than what the market would bear. So both Representative Tabke's bill and this bill, the difference between the two bills, they are looking at the surplus. We did get the surplus numbers today, so it's the one-time payment. So it's not the ongoing 10 years or 15 years where you be getting a payment from the state. Those of you who may be familiar with the program, there used to be incentive payments to try to encourage people to sign up from the federal government. In addition, there used to be cost share that would be available to pay for that mix of seeds. And with the different practices, there are different seed mixes, and those different seed mixes have different values and different costs. So when the bills talk about setting up, having the board set those rates, that you look at those practices, and some rates may have a greater cost. So the intent of the bill and Representative Tabke's bill is to match some of that at initial sign up. It's not going to look at the long cost, but it may make it at least a little bit easier to sign up to you're not losing that cost of seeding, and you're getting that incentive to enroll. In addition, so the way I would envision this is a landowner goes into their federal office, their FSA office, the Farm Service Agency. They sign up for a program. If they are successful in that bid, they go right in the same building to the Soil and Water Conservation District, and they look at, you signed up for, let's say, a CP26 program. This had this many rates. The Board of Water and Soil Resources, in conjunction with the federal government, looks at what those rates and those costs are, and they cut you a check. Maybe it's $100, maybe it's $200 an acre, that helps you so you're not having that rate, that cost, that upfront cost for enrolling in the program. My bill is for the continuous enrollment because the actual general sign up will end. I know there are efforts by the different conservation organizations asking for the general sign up to be extended because the enrollment rate is so low. I think the enrollment rate is not going to be dramatically affected by an extension of the sign up unless there is money available to make the enrollment better. So the continuous CRP are those smaller tracts. They have to be like under 10 acres. They're often the buffers, they're often the pollinator habitat, so they're smaller pieces targeted. So my 1.75 that I'm asking for was, I was looking at the target that we got last year, not knowing what the surplus would be, and looking at one-time money, I was being conservative in asking for a smaller amount of money. And I think that that's a conversation. I don't know what the executive branch will ask for, but I think that this is something that is important to try to engage to get CRP, at least keeping it on the landscape, and then maybe having new properties come on. I know the testifiers that spoke with Representative Tabke's bill, I don't know if they would like to speak again on this piece. I know there are a couple of other testifiers who are wanting to testify on this bill.
Do any of the previous testifiers want to speak again?
So if you don't remember, I was up here a minute ago, Joe Dugan with Pheasants Forever. And I guess all I could say is that having the tool of CRP to help get conservation on the ground, get grasslands, protect water, and obviously, you know, promote wildlife populations is a great tool. And with the slight dip in the federal support per acre, having a little sweetener on the table might help induce people to take advantage of that. And so I think for a minimal investment in the state side, we can attract a lot of federal dollars and get a lot of good conservation on the ground. So we're very much supportive of this bill and hope it passes. That's all I got.
Thank you. And we also have Mr. Stu Laurie from the Minnesota Farmers Union. And if there are any other testifiers for this bill, if you'd please come down.
Thank you, Chair Claflin and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Stu Laurie. I'm the Government Relations Director for Minnesota Farmers Union. And just wanted to speak briefly in support of this investment. Of course, MFU supports conservation programs. When we went out to DC in our national fly-in, this was one of the main things that we talked about. And of course, our members not only talked about the environmental benefits and the benefits for the soil, which of course they care about as well, but also look at conservation through the lens of when we take land out of production, that helps stabilize commodity prices for everyone else and make sure that farmers can stay on the land. So that's what the perspective that our farmer members come with and glad to support this investment. Thanks for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Laurie, tell me what the conversation is in Washington, D.C. about streamlining and simplifying CRP, because, like I just said earlier, it's going away, and it's going away because it's complicated. I don't hear anyone say something about the money.
I hear that, absolutely. And unfortunately, I'm not able to speak to that at this time. We were mostly talking to legislators. I don't know that we shared a lot about that, but I'm sure that's a concern that you're hearing and that our folks up in Northwest Minnesota are hearing as well. So happy to reach out to our delegation and see what they're doing on in that respect.
Any further questions? Any final remarks, Representative Hansen?
Thank you. I would renew my motion that House File 2957 be sent to Ways and Means.
Representative Hansen renews his motion. Representative Fabian.
So this is going to Ways and Means, did you say?
Yep.
Correct.
And the previous bill is going to
climate.
Yeah. So help me out here. Why are we going two different tracks? I'm missing something.
The previous bill was part of the Minnesota, let me get the acronym correct.
Climate.
Yep. The Minnesota the Climate Action Caucus. And I suppose that they want to hear more about the climate impacts.
So what, I'm sorry.
Representative Fabian.
What's the difference between the two bills?
Representative Wagenius would like to see the climate bill, and this one is going to Ways and Means. This is a general, or the continuous sign-up. The other was a general sign-up that would be affecting more acres. And I would ask anybody would like to co-author the bill. It has a fairly broad bipartisan support, and they're looking for additional support.
Thank you. Representative Hansen renewed his motion that House File 2957 be recommended to be re-referred to Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No. Aye.
The motion prevails, and it's on to Ways and Means. There is no further business in front of the committee, and we are adjourned.